What's good, y'all? For first-time listeners, welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock. And for those who've tuned in before, welcome back. A few weeks back, we took a trip to East LA College where I interviewed John Mosley Jr., head coach of their men's basketball team. For two seasons, Mosley and crew have been the subject of Last Chance U Basketball, a Netflix original series that covered the lives of these student-athletes, the coaching staff, and all the moving parts of the team. Fresh off an unfortunate state Final Four loss, Coach Mosley sat down with host Akil Pinnock, where he spoke about avoiding negative influences while growing up in a tough community, learning that you can be yourself and still serve the Lord while attending a Christian college, having reservations about being covered by the show, the impact of the show, coaching difficult players, and sacrificing me time to pour into his family and players. Catch both seasons of Last Chance U Basketball on Netflix. Please rate, comment, and subscribe. Words matter. Welcome to the Words Matter Pod with Akil Pinnock, a podcast dedicated to storytellers. I'm here with the coach of East Los Angeles College men's basketball team, one of the most successful junior college men's basketball programs in the country. That for two seasons has been the subject of Netflix's docuseries, Last Chance U Basketball. Coach John Mosley Jr., how are you?
Doing well, man. Actually just got back yesterday. We're in the Final Four, and we came up short in the Final Four, but guys did well, and represented well, and just an amazing run this year. So just heading back from that, and getting back in the swing of things, and have to start all over again, getting these guys out, transferred out, and recruiting new guys in, and the guys that are here, just keeping them in mode for next year.
Yeah, and I know that got to be difficult, because usually you guys are pretty successful every year, but you know, I guess it really doesn't. Well, it does mean something morally, but when it comes to the, you know, the big dance, you don't fully execute. It's definitely heartbreaking.
Yeah, you know what? I think the guys, I can't expect anything more than what they've, it just swung at the wrong time, and we're kind of in control of that last game a little bit. We felt that, and it just swung, and, eventually, actually the team won the state. Won the championship, that's the team we lost to, but it swung at the wrong time, but there's lessons there, and our guys are still winning because they're doing well in the classroom, and they're transferring and moving on. I mean, that's just one feather, but all the other things that the young man and myself, we wanted to accomplish, we accomplished this year, and it's just getting them off to school now. I think a lot of people put a lot on it. I mean, that's the ultimate goal,
yeah,
is to win the state title, but there's a lot of accomplishments this year, so I'm proud of what we've done.
Yeah. Let's talk about, like, your upbringing, your childhood, and, you know, what led you to where we are right now.
Well, it starts, man. You know, it's interesting. My dad, he, I think I was maybe 7 or 8 years old and got us into the Cub Scouts. And with that, he decided to be one of the leaders in the Cub Scout and Boy Scouts. And then from there, he would take the young men out and take myself out. And the first thing I actually played was Pop Warner football. So I went out and played football. And from there, he was looking for things to get us into in basketball. So baseball came up. And basketball was the one I stuck with and I was most comfortable with and had a lot of success. And so went up through middle school and high school, went to Washington Prep High School, which is inner city school. And that's where you kind of learn some things. You learn some things about just being in the inner city. You look around and you see those that look like you going through things like what you're going through right deep in the inner city. I'm watching, you know, not to just boast about the negative, but I did see people, you know, I've seen drive-bys and didn't think anything of it. I was like, oh, look, across the street, drive-by, my boy got shot. And you look and you see it, and then you see people – get shot and killed and really on my own campus. I've seen it in high school, and it was just normal. But basketball was the outlet, and that was something that kept me from being involved in it. I had great parents. I was fortunate, but, you know, sports and all those things, it was something that kept me out of trouble, and it kept me going. It kept me away from it, and I pursued that and went through Washington High School. And because, athletically I could have been a lot better. And then also academically, I wasn't as strong as I needed to be, and that led me to community college, junior college. And out of all the schools, this was the school I kind of felt a lot of love, and I felt like, man, shoot, I can be a star. Yeah. And, you know, as a young man, that's kind of what you're looking for.
It's all it's about.
Yeah, yeah, it's all it's about is trying to go somewhere you could be the man. And I ended up here at East LA College, and from there I moved on and made all state honorable mention. I led, you know, I was a Magic Johnson fan, man, growing up in LA. So did a good job and led the state in assist. And with that, even had some Division I opportunities. And again, I struggled academically, and not because I didn't have it. So I get these young men. Not that I just didn't have it up top, but I just, you know, some of the habits that it takes to be a strong academic student, you know, I just wasn't about it, man. I was a procrastinator and those, you know, some of those different habits. And so I move on. I missed out on some Division I opportunities, but I eventually had an opportunity at the NAI. It was the master's college, but, you know, it was the best thing that happened for me. And right now it's the master's university. So you get a lot of it. It was a high level at the time, really high level basketball sports program at the NAI level, always a top 10 program at that time. And then spiritually, it was an amazing spot. It helped me spiritually, change my life there, and then academically. So there's a lot of things that evolved there that kind of shaped who I am and the direction that I'm going and my purpose and my mission. All those things that affected me, man. Some of the highs and lows, the things that I went through that I failed at, and the things that I had success at, and then the things that was kind of there to pick me up and mold me. It was everything. It was the schools that I went to. It was the people that I were around. So you say, well, he went to a lower school here or there, but you know what? It was all God's design for me to be at that place to kind of plant a seed in kind of my heart to want to minister as I went. You know, to the master's college. I come from the hood, and it's kind of grimy and tough, and so I carry that everywhere I go, and I carry that on my shoulder. Like, man, I'm from the hood. I'm, you know, I'm like, what's up? I'm grimy. I'm tough. Y'all don't know what's up. And then I get to a place where I'm kind of in a place where I'm broken, and I go to this college where everybody's about ministry, and it's not about self. It's about serving. And so I'm kind of, it's all kind of mixed up, and it just comes together, and it's a big melting pot of how God designed me to be where I'm at right now.
Were you already on the path to finding the Lord when you got to the master's college?
You know what? There was a conviction. There was a seed. There was always a I think they say, an inkling or a pressing on my heart when I was young. You know, I grew up in the church. And, you know, it was, you know, back in the day, you didn't have a choice when you were little. You go on to church with mom and you in the choir, you serve and you doing Easter programs, Christmas programs, you doing all that. So you really didn't have a choice, which I think, you know, now today you know, you guys may slap me on the wrist, but I think our parents are giving our children too many choices and we're allowing them to have too many choices instead of just kind of directing them towards truth and what they know is right and saying, well, I'm going to let my kid figure out what's right. Nah, I'm going to share what our family believes and my core value, what I believe my family should believe in and what my children should be doing. And then after that, they have their choices once they leave my house.
Yeah,
and I think that's what my parents did. They kind of directed me in that direction, and that's what they believed in. So those seeds were planted early. And then for me, as those seeds were planted, I realized that that's the direction that God wanted for me. And I was kind of I was kind of protected so that I can be in this purpose. Once I got out there on my own, I was protected. And those seeds were there, man. And then once I saw ministry from other people, and I saw it at the university at Master's College that I went to, and I saw other people serving that you can play basketball and you can serve. You can be tough and you can serve. You can be from the hood and you can serve. Mm-hmm. It was just all together a big melting pot. I mean, yeah. I can shout, I can holler for the Lord, but then I can also share truth through the Bible, which I learned in college. So it's a lot, man. But I'm grateful for the path that I'm on. It's just amazing.
Do you think that if you were to go to a Christian college maybe a Christian college closer to LA, that you would have had the same journey?
You know what, that was, I mean, you know, I don't know, man. I had my life planned out, you know, when I was younger, and it didn't turn out that way.
Yeah.
I think that, what's that saying say, and you tell God your plans, and you want to hear God laugh, you just tell him your plans.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, man. It could have. I don't know. I'm just grateful for how it turned out. Never thought I'd be sitting in this position that I'm in, and all of the things that's happened up until now in terms of, you know, show Last Chance U coming and me having an opportunity to share or be on the platform to share my view of servant leadership and ministry and sharing my coaching and all that stuff and that being on a platform. I never thought that would be something that would be impacting others. You know, it's not even about basketball. It's about impacting others and sharing that. So it's not about me, man. A lot of people probably think I'm in it for that. And nah, it's really about planting seeds. And I'm actually told, I said, you know what, I'm pretty much done with it because I'm done with, you know, even being perceived as it's about me. It's about just the ministry.
Yeah.
And the overall intention when it started was to make sure that the seed was planted that, you know, whatever I do is to glorify God.
Are you talking about the show, Last Chance U?
Yeah. Yeah. Or just coaching.
Yeah.
Anything we do, it's the purpose is to glorify God.
Yeah.
So I you know, to step away from it, now I'm completely okay with it.
Yeah.
Because, you know, you get, you know, speculation that, oh, it's about him. Like, now, you know what, it's time to step away because, no, it's not about me. It's about continuing to spread the gospel.
Was there one moment in your life? I know you told me that you grew up in the church, but was there that one moment that led you back to the Lord, or was it a series of events?
Just a series of events, man. I think there was always a pressing, you know, all the way since I was young. My mom used to ask me, she'd say, what does it sound like when the Lord speaks to you? And that's not a conversation you have with a 10 and 11-year-old. And I would share with her some things that when I thought I was, you know, I had a pressing from God and I had a calling. And I would share with her, and she would sit there and listen as if she was as if I was teaching or if it was something that she hadn't experienced. And she was amazed at what I was experiencing, and it was something that she wasn't. So there was always a pressing. And I remember one time I was walking down the street, man. I had some J's. My wife just brought my son, I think it was the Jordan 3s or something like that. I had the Jordan 3s, and it was the first pair of Jordans I ever got. It was in the
late
80s, man. And I was walking down the street, and, you know, Cutlass pulled me over, or pulled over and said, what's up, bro? What size shoe you wear? And I said, what size?
Oh, boy.
And they said, where are you from? And I said, I don't bang, man. I just hoop. And, you know, it's amazing the respect factor. One of the, you know, the neighbors out on the street came out in her nightgown, and she said, John, you okay? And I said, yeah, I'm all right. And then the Cutlass kind of pulled, you know, they was getting out the car to try to take my shoes, and they left. And I remember going home crying, saying, I'm just tired of this and tired of that. And I said, Lord, you know, and I called out to the Lord then. And then I can remember, even at the college, kind of getting in trouble with the administration a little bit when I first got to the college. And I can remember saying, Lord, I don't want to lose the scholarship. And there was a conviction there. And then finally, I remember I wasn't playing at the college when I first started basketball. And I just was sitting on the bench. I remember I wasn't playing. I was like, dude, what in the heck, bro? I'm John Mosley. Why am I not playing at this little weak college? You know, I call myself, I'm supposed to be a Division I player, and I'm here not playing.
But then who was John Mosley?
Yeah, it was John Mosley. And then eventually, there was this conviction that came over me, and I just sat on the bench and I watched the game, and I just smiled and I was content. And I said, you know what? However you want to use me, Lord, go ahead. I'm done. I'm humbled. I'm sitting here. This is embarrassing. I'm humbled, and I just smiled. I said, whatever, let your will be done. And then literally the next game, it wasn't a wish or anything. Literally the next game, one of my teammates got injured, and I ended up playing. And then a few games later, I was starting, and I ended up helping the team to be in a better team, what I thought my vision was. But at that time, God had to just break me. And eventually I ended up playing and being a huge part of it and realized that it's about ministering and it's about him. And he had to break me before he can use me.
Mm. Yeah. I think we all got to go through series of humbling events to, you know, eventually learn who we are. In an article profiling you, about your alma mater, the Masters University. It says that you were initially hesitant to share your faith, but you eventually did after being urged by your teammates. What made you so hesitant to share your faith even while attending a Christian college?
Well, you know what? So the Christian college, it was conservative. So yeah. I'm like one of the only brothers there, and there's only a few of us, a few teammates or brothers, and it was a conservative college, and it was mostly white, but it was a great college in terms of faith-based and the Bible teaching and the Bible learning and all that. So what happened is there's this missions trip. And so they say, hey, let's go on this missions trip. I was like, man, what am I going to do going on this missions trip, go to Brazil? But then they were saying, hey, but if you go, maybe you can play pro ball. You get seen by the pro teams because we play against pro teams. So what's crazy is that was my intentions. It was like, oh, yeah, I'm going to go just so I can play pro ball. But in order to go on the missions trip, there was a class you had to take. It was like a missions prep where you can learn about just how to share your faith and some tools you can use. And so I'm listening to all of these tools and these things to share your faith. And they're like, yeah, you can do this and do that. And they have all these, this outline. First you want to do this, first you want to do that. And then you want to open up, and then you want to present the gospel, and then you want a call to faith. And I'm thinking like, man, this is just too much. I can't do this. It sounds like it was just like way too organized and structured. And I'm like, man, so, you know, I'm looking, I said, I can't do that. I'm like, well, whatever. If that's how you share your faith and if that's how you share the gospel, then I probably can't do it, you know. But then we go to Brazil, and ultimately there's a lot of people that kind of look like me, and it felt like where I came from. It was some that kind of came from some social, economic, struggling backgrounds. And, you know, the kids in the areas we went to, there's kids that were, you know, homeless. There was kids that didn't have much, and there was kids that – you could tell they just came from backgrounds, maybe abusive, and just all those different things. And it just felt a little bit more familiar. So we would do clinics, and I just felt at home with those kids and would talk with those kids. And ironically, those who, you know, I thought would be comfortable with sharing their faith and they knew what to do, they were a little more uncomfortable than I was. I was comfortable. So as you play these professional teams and you have these crowds and you share your faith, and we play against them, and we do clinics, and we share their faith, and there's an order. Everybody gets an opportunity to share. And as we go through this order, my turn is coming up, and I'm sitting up here like, oh, my gosh, I can't do this, whatever. So I finally get up there, and as I'm looking around, there's this big crowd. We're in this arena after we halftime of this game where we played exhibition. And I'm looking, and I'm like, man, these are my people, and they look like me, and I'm sharing my faith about my experience, and I can relate, and I ultimately shared about, you know, just a young man that I grew up with, and he ended up getting caught up, and he was about to lose his life, and he didn't because someone saved his life.
Yeah, I read that story.
And I flipped it, and ultimately we talked about, it was a surprise that I shared that the one who saved his life was Christ. And so and it shocked all the people who were talked about, and so I was able to. Well, I shared the story that he was going to lose his life through the violence that they've been going through and I went through. Mm. And so it captured him. And then at that point, the group that we were with, they kind of looked and they said, man, that was awesome. I'm like, what are you talking about? Like, and they just was like, dude, you know, you have it's an amazing opportunity to share your faith, at least to that group and that population. And they said, can you do it more? Trip and I'm like, yeah, sure. And it was just relaxed. And then I came back, and as soon as I came back from Brazil, I started this group called Save Through Hoops. And it was at my old high school. I would go invite all the middle school kids, do a clinic, and I would share my faith and realize that God had a calling, and that I really he gave me a gift to share my faith to those that experience the same things I experienced and come from where I come from, you know. And that was something that I always remembered. But the amazing part is like, man, I could do that and play basketball and share it through basketball and use basketball as a tool to draw people. That basketball can be that carrot. And that's the way I view it today, and that's the way I view this ministry now. It's a carrot to kind of bring them in and kind of help them, and all that aren't saved, but maybe I can share nuggets. And even guys on my team now, and players, you know, I don't expect them to believe what I believe. You know, that's up to God to decide if that's what he wants. But to be able to plant seeds, to even help them with life skills and faith if they need it, just all that, to just be able to speak and realize that I can impact and just realize and saw my dad do it, comfortable with young men in the inner city. He'd bring them home, man, and they come to my house 5 minutes from a high school, and he's cutting up potatoes, man. Hmm. Take a bucket of potatoes, and he cut them up, and then he fry them, and the guys eat and popcorn, whatever. He saw him come through the door, man. He would make something for him to eat, and he was a man's man, and he saw those young men, and he celebrated young men, and I get a little bit of that from him as well. So,
yeah. So basketball is your ministry.
Basketball is the ministry. You know, sometimes the competitive side, a lot of that comes out, and I gotta be reminded.
Yeah,
God has to remind me, like, it's still a ministry. Sometimes, you know, I get so consumed with it that it wouldn't look like it, and that's where I get I'm humbled, and I get a little kind of ashamed. I was like, man, I gotta remember it's about ministry, not just about basketball.
What makes a basketball player want to become a coach?
You know what I missed? Team. And I remember once I finished playing and once I finished coach, I was like, man, I'm going to be an actor. I'm going to do this. I'm going to do that. I'm going to be a fireman. I had tons of things I wanted to do. I'm going to own my own business. I was doing, the little pyramid scheme businesses. Then I was doing multi-level marketing business. I was doing everything. I thought I was that guy. And then I was trying to act. I was modeling. I was doing a bunch of stuff. But when I finished, I had one more class to finish, and I called my coach. I said, hey, I got one more class to finish. He said, why don't you come on the bench and sit with me? And it was something that I missed, and I missed the team. And I think for me, I missed the team aspect of it and being around the guys and just having fun and just having a group of guys and team. You know, I've been a part of a team since I was 8 years old.
Yeah.
And so I think I missed that. And when I came back and he said, hey, just come and I'll help you, help me out for and just sit on a bench and just volunteer or whatever and help me out. And when I realized that I really enjoyed it and I missed it. And I realized that I can, I'm still competitive. And when I sat with my coach, and he was good, he was a Hall of Fame coach. When I sat with him and I learned the coaching side of it, I just knew him as a coach, and it just felt like coaches are like, you know, eh. You know, you love them, you know they mean best, but man, they don't let you be free.
Yeah.
But when you get on the coaching side and you realize and you see the whole aspects of coaching and how you can develop men and all that, I really fell in love with that too.
How does it feel to get all this newfound publicity for coaching, you know, because of the show Last Chance U Basketball?
It's kind of bittersweet because, you know, we felt like we've done a good job here. I feel like I've done a good job from the beginning. And, you know, I remember sitting with John Wooden. My mentor used to have breakfast with John Wooden a lot. His name was Bill Oates. And so I got a chance maybe once a year. He would go like a couple times a month. I got like once a year to sit with Wooden back in the day in the late 80s, early 2000s, late 90s, I'm sorry, early 2000s.
What John Wooden was the coach of UCLA.
Yeah, or, yeah.
You know, for everybody who don't know.
Yeah, I got a chance, and I can just remember one of the first conversations he said was, and he still said it on many platforms, he said, for every high, there's a low. Don't get too high. Don't get too low. And, you know, there's some that will say I'm the worst coach. I can't do this. I still get that criticism. And there's some that just send DMs and messages, oh, man, you're the GOAT, you're the greatest. And I'm like, nah, I'm just, you know, the show, they capture some things that was polarizing and maybe look a little bit better than I was. And at the same time, there are some things that captured me and things that people don't like that make me look like I'm not as good as people think I should be. So I just take it all in and remember that I'm not as good. And I think Jerry West said, you're not as good as people say you are, and he's not as bad as people say you are. So I'm just right there, man, and just trying to get better. And one thing that I remember, and it kind of brought me down to reality, is just going over, spending time in Australia, and it was playing on the second division. My best friend was on the NBL, in Australia, and I was playing like the CBA yeah. or something like that. And I went over there, and it was just cameras, and everybody kind of knew who I was, and I was in Sydney, and it was like kind of famous, and I was feeling myself. So I was over there a couple months, and then I can remember, man, coming back home and landing in Tom Bradley Airport. When I got off the plane, my chest was out, and I'm looking around, and ain't nobody know who I was. And just again, man, for every high, there's a low. Nobody cares who you are, man. And the fame is just 15 minutes, man. I got about a year or two, and nobody really gonna care.
You know? Yeah.
And the impact I'm having right now on these young men that the cameras captured, I'm going to try to do the same thing 15, 20 years from now. And it may even be better than what we saw on camera. And I felt like there's some times that we've done some amazing things that wasn't captured years prior. But our program has been successful before the show, and I'm praying it'll continue to be successful after.
2021 article by The Wrap, you said you asked your pastor what he thought about Last Chance, you covering ELAC, and you were surprised that he encouraged you to follow through with it. Did you have any, I mean, you know, you have conflicting feelings or complicated feelings about the show now, but before the show, did you have any reservations about you and your team being covered?
Oh, absolutely. I got a cold call, and they reached out to me, and they mentioned this show, and I'm like, in my 20s, you know, I was the guy, I was the class clown, I was the energy guy, I was trying to always be seen, and God did some amazing humbling of me. What I didn't realize is, there are gifts there to be in front of this big platform, but God had to just tear me down, break me down, and humble me before there was preparation for it. So in my 20s, if you hit me up, yeah, man, come see me. I'm ready for all of the cameras. But I got to a point where, there was a humbling period where, I didn't want any part of that. And God showed me that, no, you don't need any notoriety. You don't need anything. What you need to do is just focus and understand the purpose. And it's just ministry. And it's about whatever God's will is and whatever his will is to be done. And so, you know, you have this heart change. So when they called me, I'm like, I'm not doing that. I don't need any of that anymore. That's not who I am. I don't want notoriety. I don't want television. I don't want any of that. And I asked a few friends. It was like, yeah, man, don't do it. You're going to get fired. Just keep what you're doing in the box. And I was just panicked. I was like, yeah, you're right. I know something's going to happen. I'll get fired. They'll see something.
Yeah.
They're going to see one of my guys doing something. And then everybody's going to say, oh, he should be fired. He should let the kids do this and that. He's going to say something. He's going to get fired. And then there's two people out of everybody. There's about two. Friend of mine, he's a junior college coach. He's a believer himself. He said, "No, man, you should do it, man. Show how we ministering and what we doing behind the scenes with these young brothers, man. It's not just about taking advantage of them, but we really trying to pour into their lives and minister and plant seeds and share our faith." And then my pastor, I'm like, okay, he told me that. I was like, yeah, I don't know still. And then I called my pastor. I said, hey, I got this opportunity. I'm just assuming he's like, nah, you just want to stay away from that and let's just minister and be humble and serve God that way. And he said, no, it's a great opportunity for you to share. And I said, but what about those who, once they get in front of the camera, they just lose it and they start going crazy and acting up and everything comes out? He said, well, if that's the case, they probably were that before the cameras came out. And he said, I don't think you're that way and you're not that way. And by the way, I would say, well, what about if I might get fired if I do something happens? He says, well, you predestined and God's called you. They shut the door there and he opened up another one. And so I went on and did it. And I was literally said, okay, I'm going to do it. And then I kind of got into a panic. And after we started the project, I said, what am I doing? And then ultimately I came at peace with it. And then months come up and the show's about to come out. And they said, okay, it's going to release here in a month. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I'm in a cold sweat in my sleep. Lord, what did I just do? My life was perfect. I was, secluded. I was kind of hidden, enjoying my little world. We got this great basketball program that I really didn't care to be elevated. I didn't have any social media or anything. My Twitter was up, but I hadn't tweeted ever. Never had an Instagram, no Facebook. I had LinkedIn because I figured that was just being professional.
Yeah.
But no Twitter, no tweets. And I had the Twitter up since, I think, maybe 2009. But I never used it, never tweeted, never wanted any type of attention or anything like that. Never wanted to be on display or anything. And I said, well, what am I doing? I decided that I wanted to be just isolated, and I just wanted to be quiet, and we wanted to move in silence and have success in silence. And what am I doing? Why did I flip it? I was like, Lord, does that mean that I'm going back to being, you know, who you broke me from being? And he was like, no, you know, just make sure. And I said, well, with that, I just want to make sure that you're on display. I want to make sure the seeds are planted. And we realize that there's seeds planted, and that you get your faith, your gospel's being shared in some way. And I kind of overdid it, and I was dogmatic. And the way our society is moving now, it's a cancel culture. I said, man, I probably did too much. But you know what? God had his hands on the editing, and they didn't add a lot. And they kind of really edited it in a way where it was just enough that it wasn't offensive to any as many people.
Yeah.
It may have been offensive to some, but it wasn't offensive. And I think even some that were non-believers, it wasn't offensive, but it was a great way where the seed was planted. And even those who were of the faith, they were like, man, that was awesome. And I was like, wow, I didn't think enough of it. But it was just enough. And so truly God had his hand on it. And I was grateful that God was able to use me in that way. And I was a vessel to be used. And so I'm forever grateful. And I was like, okay, Lord, that's what you wanted. And I think here at the last show at the end, I said, you know what, I don't think I want to do it anymore, because it just starts to feel unauthentic, you know, where the focus was truly to display that there was ministry going on. And then some, you know, you can go long enough, and you know, I can see how, you know, as you get out there as a star, and as I just don't know how those guys do it, those men of faith that are on that platform for a long time, you know, for years. And you're in the NBA, you're in the NFL,
without being corrupted.
It's just so hard. I can see how the corruption happens with things that have that opportunities has come upon me. I think I'm in a good space right now, and I'm like, Lord, I don't need any of that unless you push me through those doors.
Yeah. Well, you know, you have complicated feelings, but at least, you know, you were pleased with the post-production, you know, to a certain extent. So that's good to hear. You know, to get into the coaching, got into your backstory, but, you know, you coach pretty temperamental guys like Penn Johnson and Joe Hammond and Deshaun, who disagreed with a lot of your coaching decisions, but eventually these guys came around and saw your vision. Do you encounter these kinds of personalities every season?
Yeah, not just, you know, with those with, you know, that come from tough backgrounds or have, traumatizing backgrounds, but even those who had come from good parents.
Yeah.
You know, got great attitudes. Yeah, it's conflicting because you're trying to put everybody in this one vision, this one box, you know. And, yeah, you want them to understand that there's freedom, but it's freedom within this box because we got to all be on the same page. And so it's conflicting, and you get that all the time. And what's the beauty of it is I've been either that person or I've been around that person, and I know who they are. Once you really find out what's going on, and have compassion about what's going on in their lives and understand that. And once they see that, they see that you have compassion and you understand what's going on and not just yelling at them because they have a poor response, but you really know what's going on in their lives, then eventually they come around and say, he's doing it for the best. And I think that's what happens with most of the guys. You know, sometimes it takes time and to spend with them. You don't get as much time with all of them, but the majority of them, we get time with them. And at the end, they see, no, it was for the best. And although it's depressing for them to come out of, to do it this way, or pressing for them to respond better, I think at the end they see, especially when we push them out the door and we get them to the colleges and they get to the next level and they are able to use some of the things they have here. You know, it's hard to really see until you get to the next level. And then it's super duper. It's all love.
Yeah.
Yeah. But it's every year. And I look at them and I'm like, okay, they won't like me for 6 months. And then when we move on, it's just the life of a head coach, man.
Have you ever coached players who you felt were, like, completely uncoachable, like you just couldn't get through to them?
Every year. And what's the amazing part of it is those are ones you probably got through to the most.
Yeah.
Lou Holtz has said, you know, those who deserve love the least need it the most. And so you look at them, and I'm just like, dude, I just can't stand the way this person was responding and all that. And what's interesting is all of the little messages that you're sharing and all of the conflicting pushback that you're getting, really, it's really going in, but they don't want to show that it's coming in there and they're learning.
It's a prideful thing.
It's a prideful thing. And what's interesting is you'd find is some that are saying, yes, coach, and they're probably saying, yes, coach, whatever, you know, you think they're following the path. And a lot of the guys who appear to be rebellious or absorbent the most, it's just breaking down that shell and peeling that shell so that they showing that they understand. And they usually take it and they do it. And I understand that. So, yeah, there's some that it's, you feel like you just can't get through. But I'm going to keep doing it because I realize and I've seen in the past and through experience, I realized that I just got to keep sharing the message and planting seeds. And even if it doesn't come out here when they're with me, then those seeds that are planted, you know, it'll come, you know, when they get to the next level.
Yeah. A lot of, you know, when you watch a show, you see that a lot of your athletes have the ultimate goal of playing pro ball, whether it be overseas or the NBA. How realistic is that dream coming from the JUCO level?
It's possible, but there's a lot. You know, first there's the talent. That's the number one piece. You got to have the talent to do it. And then you have to have the work ethic, and you have to have what they say, I guess, luck, you know, or you got to be blessed. Something special at right place, right time. Especially from our level, unless you're this super natural talent like LeBron James, then you're in this category where you know, it's like what it 80-20, about 20% of the guys where he's like, okay, they're freaks, they just work hard, they're gonna go.
Yeah.
And then there's this group where, you know, where there's maybe a bottom group that just won't go, it just won't happen, even if they work hard, just they don't have the ability. But then there's a big chunk that all can probably make it. If they have this psychotic work ethic like a Steph Curry. And just trying to get the young man to put that in perspective for him. Like, I'm sitting here and I'm watching you, and you have some habits that probably brought you to this level. And if you're saying you really want to make it, you have to break these habits, and you have to flip it, and you have to be psychotic about your work, and you have to be there's have to be a just relentless pursuit if you really want to make it. And the reason why you here at the community college, we have to question that and we have to correct that, you know? And then from that point on, then there's got to be this relentless, unbelievable, crazy, psychotic pursuit for that. And a lot of these young men fall short of that and don't realize it. And in some cases, they start to get a reality check and realize, well, man, going to take a lot, or I don't know if I'm willing to do that. But I remind them every day, oh, you said you wanted to do this, you said you wanted to be this, then where's the coach? Is the gym open? Or I didn't see you shoot extra after, or you know, I'm looking at your academics, you got to get that done first. And so the relentless pursuit for it is making the sacrifice for things that, you know, on and off the court. And reality hits when they start to see they're making great sacrifices. These young men, they do a lot, but the reality sets in with themselves, and they say, "Man, he's telling us, giving us these expectations of what it takes to make it." And they kind of like, "Yeah, I hold them accountable every day."
Yeah.
I say, "I don't see you doing it," and they check themselves and they say, "Yeah, I'm really not doing it. Maybe it's probably best that I just make sure I focus and get to college and get my degree." And you know, the reality starts to set in a
little bit.
When I share with them, if you want to make it, if you want to be a pro, here's the expectation.
A lot of people can't, or not willing to, or didn't even understand that those were the expectations.
Yeah. And they're like, shoot, that's a lot. And when you hold them accountable to it every day, and I'm saying, okay, you said you wanted this, but you taking off right after practice, or you're not here early, or your academics aren't where they need to be, I remind them every single day. It's like, okay, you're still a good junior college player. You're going to be good. You're all conference, but You said you wanted to make it to the, you said you wanted to go high major. You said you wanted this. And right now the relentless pursuit isn't there. And I remind him every day, this is what you wanted. I'm not seeing it. And that continual pursuit, if that's what you want, this is what it needs to be. And so I think there's an awakening period. I want to make sure they're awakened and they understand the expectations as they move forward here. And some of them, they have the ability and they could, but I want to make sure before you walk out the door here that you have a clear understanding of what the expectations are and what your expectations should be based on your work.
Yeah. It seems like being a coach can be, you know, very mentally exhausting. Is this something that you've grown accustomed to, or, you know, like, is it something you've grown accustomed to, or you mentally prepare yourself for?
Yes, it's exhausting, and you have to find ways to kind of refill. But you have to know that you're going into this thing, and the 15 guys or how many ever guys you got in the coaching staff and everybody, that you're a leader of that group, and you have to pour into all of them, and you have to have a system in place and support in place, and you have to have a structure in place that allows that to kind of, you know, run on autopilot in some ways, where, you know, there's a lot of pouring into, and you got to be built for it. If not, there's some people that's not built for it, and there's some cases it's like, I just don't want to deal with this. I'm tired. I'm worn out. But there's a conviction that I have that always convicts me. It's like, man, I can't leave this kid hanging. And so I think that's where the motivation comes from. I can't, you know, I see their eyes. I see myself. I see that kid that's pretending they got this front as if they know it all or they got it figured out. But I really see behind it, and I see that they really are crying out for help. Otherwise, why are they here? Why do they show up every day? They're here. Or why, you know, they can put on the front all they want, but they really want what's best. And I can't run from giving my all into that.
Yeah. You spend a lot of time with the team, you know, naturally, you know, building bonds with these players. And, you know, you spend, you know, you also have your own family and they play sports as well. And your son plays basketball. So is it difficult, you know, balancing, like, you know, you're spending all this time with your family. I mean, you're spending all this time with your team, and then, you know, you're spending time with your son. And it's like, how do you make sure that one doesn't feel like one is being over prioritized than the other?
So I share this a lot, and everybody asks me the question. I'm 100% in the moment, and pour into it. And I think what has to sacrifice, the sacrifice that has to be made, it's not the career or the team here, it's not my family, the sacrifices. I'm saying, if I really want to pour into these young men and still pour into my family, or pour into my family 100% and still pour into these guys in this group, then there has to be a sacrifice. And the sacrifice is me.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't play golf. You know, I don't go to bars and drink with, I don't go have men's night. I don't go have, let's go to here and go there. I don't have me time. You know, my me time is pouring into either here or it's pouring into my family. And I kind of think that's what happens is, you know, you get a little bit of suffering because it's like, hey, and maybe I'm wrong. Maybe I'll burn out. They say, no, you got to have your own time. Go spend some time, Mosley. Go take a vacation and you do go do you. And I'm just like, but then when I leave from these guys, vacation from these guys, then my family needs 100%.
Yeah.
And then when I leave 100% for my family, then these guys need me. And so I just don't have that me time. And I can remember they asked me, and I can see some of my friends, they would have this, we'd go out, you go recruit, and you spend so much time away from home. And then when you're away, and hopefully none of my buddies or anybody calls me and gets pissed off, but when I was a Division I coach, you know, you go out and you would go recruit, and I got some buddies who, you know, maybe were married, and some of their marriages struggled. Well, you go recruit, and you're at these events all day. And I can remember back in the day, it was in Las Vegas, where everything was in Las Vegas. All the basketball events were there. And it's literally game start at 8 in the morning, and the last game is at 9. So, and they finish late because they're all running late. So you finish the games at 10 or 10, whatever. But you go 5 days, you know, you can go multiple days in a row, and you have to sit there and watch all day. So you do that. You wake up. You maybe don't talk to your family, and then you go all the way to the end. And I think this is where it starts to break down the family, is when you go back and then you say, okay, whew, the recruiting is over. Now I'm going to have a beer. Now I'm going to hang out, and I'm going to do that. Instead of saying, you know what, my wife is calling. I'm sitting in a hotel, and let me plan out my next day. And so that's where my wife, my family understands the commitment.
Yeah.
They already understand that it's 14-hour days sometimes. They understand that when I'm in practice, I can't answer my phone. So, well, my wife is mad because I don't answer my phone during practice, or my wife is mad because I don't call. Well, that's because
you have to communicate that.
Yeah, and that's because when practice was over, you didn't talk, or that's because you didn't come straight home when they knew you had, you've already spent the 14 hours. So it's not spend the 14 hours and then go have some me time. It's 14 hours and then it's family. Even if it's 3 out to 1 hour with family, at least they get that little bit of window that you have. Not go have some me time afterwards and then the wife is trying to get some time and is like, no, don't you know I got to go back to work? So I know I may get criticized for that, but that's just me. And I think that's what works, because my wife understands the commitment and she knows it's 14-hour days and all that. But after those after the 14-hour days or the 10-hour days or whatever it is, then it's family.
Yeah.
And my children understand the same thing, and they see me at games when I can make it. If I don't have a game, I'm going. I'm not going. I'm going, and I've made the sacrifice to do it. And I've missed some games. It was really tough to, you know, my son had some key games this year. They played probably in the best conference in the country. You know, they got a chance to play against Sierra Canyon and, you know, they were in the best best conference in the country.
Yeah.
With 3 teams in the top 20. And so that's fun for him to play in and be a part of, and for family to see. And he was one of the best players in the conference, you know, one of the best players on his team. And that's fun to watch as a father. And I missed a couple because their conference games on the same nights as mine. But he understood that. But when I did have the time, I was there.
Yeah.
And I would run and watch. And, heck, I would leave my practice and go watch his practice. I'll just be there and watch him practice if I can't make it to the game. So I think that's what – or I come home from a Friday night game and I'm tired and I'm worn out, but I'll wake up and take my daughter 6, 7 a.m. to softball. Practice, you know, like – that's all I got. I'm going to do it. Not, I'm going to just go and sleep in or whatever.
Yeah.
And because I'm tired. So I think that's the sacrifice we have to make. I just don't have me time.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, but as long as that's communicated, you know, that's the best you can do.
Yeah.
We recently saw that NBA star Ja Morant was penalized for brandishing a weapon on Instagram Live. And you've coached players who've gotten into trouble with the law. Or just, you know, come from the hood. Is there anything that coaches can do, or maybe you've done already, to prevent these kinds of reckless behaviors?
Just provide, man, those examples of how it can really impact your life and make those decisions. I mean, it's like, it's you know, Ja Morant isn't waving a gun around every day.
Yeah.
Like, he's an NBA player. He's got a basketball in his hand, literally. It literally 0.1% of his life he probably is waving a gun and he gets caught. So that's not who he is. It's just he allowed that to be on display with himself. And, you know, you kind of feeling yourself and you feeling comfortable and you feeling a little invincible, and you feel you forget that those mistakes can really be catastrophic. And we've all done it. And I would say 100% of the NBA players have done something reckless that just haven't been caught.
Yeah. Especially pre-social media.
Pre-social media. Mm-hmm. And it's 100%. 100% all of us who are demonizing Ja Morant. And that's where my, you know, the compassion that I have come in. It's like we all are doing something or have done something. All of us, we're just not on that platform. Well, that's wrong. Well, he can't. You know what? You're doing something behind whatever. You know, you're cheating on your taxes. We're just not caught. And so to demonize him, he shouldn't, because he is a star and he will be an example to others. And, yeah, you're right about that. But to just say that that's 100% who he is, we all do reckless things here and there. Some of us drink, you know, you drink too much.
Yeah.
And there's some that appear to be saints and they're driving home drunk and they just haven't crashed. They haven't been caught and there's a lot
yeah.
that we are condemning or demonizing people. And yes, he's wrong, but we're all wrong. And that's where it comes in. We're all sinners, and I see it. So when the young men do things reckless, I'm like, look, I understand and I know. But let me tell you how this can impact your life. So that's my approach, not to condemn them right away. My approach is like, look, man, you've done it. You want to do this. You want to smoke. But this is what could happen. This is the impact it's going to have. So to immediately condemn them, and Christ didn't immediately condemn anybody. He said, I don't want to be around the self-righteous. He said, I didn't come to the world to heal the well. I came to the world to heal the sick. So he wants to be amongst those who are having those issues. He wants to be among and not condemn them. He didn't come to condemn the world, but he came to save it. So, you know, myself, I'm not here to condemn any young men. I'm just here to say, man, let me save you from that mistake you're going to make. And that's kind of the approach that I'm trying to take instead of, because the media is condemning them. Yeah. Everybody, those that are sitting at home on the couch and they having a beer, they condemning Ja Morant. And he's wrong. Yes, he is. And, you know, you talk about his dad. Yeah, I mean, dad should probably step in. Nobody's perfect. But we're all in the same category. We're all the same.
Yeah.
So don't condemn him. Just like, dang, man, I feel bad. Let's figure out how we can share with how damaging these mistakes can be. And they're going to make mistakes, and they may never get caught. Top to bottom. I'm sure LeBron has done some things. He's like, man, that was dumb. I probably shouldn't have did that. Thankful that nobody saw it. You know, I'm 100% sure. Like, there's nobody that's mm-hmm. perfect. Like, everybody, all the clean, the people who set good examples, and LeBron is a great, you know, he just made that one mistake, and he just got loose. And it's just, so it's, I feel bad in that regard.
Yeah. Coach, you know, I'm almost, we almost coming to the end of the, you know, the road with the this interview, but I got a few more questions for you. Mm-hmm. As a coach, you're teaching players the game, but what are some of the most important things that players have taught you?
That I got to learn who they are. Like, you're not going to be able to coach any kid. You're not going to be able to coach any player or talk or help anybody until you first dive in and you learn who they are and you live out the burdens that they're going through. That's the only way that you're going to be able to coach them. So you can yell and scream at them. You can do all that. But until you really and truly know who they are, and then they know that, okay, he really cares. He knows what I'm going through. So him screaming at me or him coaching me the way he's coaching me, he knows what I'm going through, and he's doing this for my best. But until then, you're just like, womp, womp, womp. You're just noise. Because it's like, man, he don't know who I am. He don't know what I'm – he don't. And so until then, I think that's the biggest lesson I've learned. You got to learn these young men. And then through that, you learn how to coach them and you learn how to – bring them in and reel them in, and then you also learn how to give them certain freedoms based on who they are.
Yeah. And what's next for Coach John Mosey Jr.?
Right now, man, continue to do what I'm doing. I just asked, you know, as I'm driving home on the bus, we're in the Final Four, and of course I want to win a state title, and it's possible, you know. I think we do a good enough job that we can do it, and it just didn't go our way this time, but that's really the last thing to do. You know, guys are graduating, you know, multiple coaches of the year, and, you know, we've accomplished a lot. So from that standpoint, I'm good. I just asked, I said, Lord, what's next? I asked him what's next. So I don't know. That's a question you got to ask the Lord, but I'm going to continue to help these young men, and I'll just be where God wants me to be and where he wants me to minister. If I follow money, then my intentions will be all wrong. So I do have to make a living. So, you know, I'll try to take some opportunities. You know, I go out and I speak. I'll have a book. I got a couple chapters that we're finishing up that we'll put out to just talk about. I think there's some information, some of the things that I'm talking about here on the podcast and interviews, and that I can be clear. I can just lay it out clear, and those who don't get a chance to hear this platform, that they can see it, and it'll just kind of be documented.
Yeah,
some of my thoughts and what's in my head, and I won't just try to do too much, but I'll take some opportunities, but I won't try to pursue money. I'll just try to pursue hearts and try to help people. That's really what I want to do, is just serve and try to serve. And I think God will take care of me. If I'm serving others on his behalf, then he'll take care of me. I mean, we've seen that throughout history.
Yeah. My last question for you. You're a basketball coach, and the most important part of coaching is communication. That's all, you know, that's all it is. And different forms of communication based on the different kinds of players you have, the situations that you run into in game, in practice. So my final question to you is, why do words matter?
Well, the words is what comes out of, you know, the words is what comes out. And based on what your heart, whatever is in your heart, that's what's going to come out of your mouth. And so how we present those words and how we present our energy and our enthusiasm through those words and how that's really what's in our hearts. And that's the first thing, the first line of what people see. Those words is what they see, is what they see.
Yeah.
So, and then we follow it up with our actions. So like sometimes they say action speaks louder than words. But the words is the first thing we hear and the first thing we see. And it makes that first impression. And then we can follow it up with our actions. Initially, when we have a short period of time, if we have a longer period of time, we can display those actions and they can learn and we can set those examples. But in a short period of time, those words is what they see, and that's our first introduction. And so we got to be careful with how we speak and how we say and how we give off who we are.
Yeah. Thank you, Coach John Mosley Jr., for allowing me to interview you. I know you also are a teacher here at ELAC, so let me let you get back to your job. And thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I got class in this space here in just a few minutes, so thanks for coming out, man, and thanks for coming into my space
yeah.
and interviewing. Thanks.
All right, words matter.